This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
This week on Radio EcoShock, more revelations of coming climate disasters as the fossil fuel bubble expands. Even the World Bank, which funded plenty of big coal plants, admits we are headed for a world 4 degrees Celsius or 7.2 degrees Fahrenheit hotter. We'll talk with Olivia Maria Sardenci from the Potsdam Institute in Germany, authors of the report for the bank. But first, I'm going to toss you right into the deep end. If our recent broadcast of Kevin Anderson of the Tyndall Institute shocked you, Dr. Guy McPherson will blow you away. I'm not sure our industrial system will collapse anytime soon, as he says, but I fact-checked everything McPherson said about escalating climate change. He's got it right. You need to hear this. Suddenly, all the official sources are wringing their hands about the coming climate catastrophe. The accountants, like PricewaterhouseCoopers, the bankers, even the World Bank, and the International Energy Agency. Professor Kevin Anderson of Britain's Tyndall Center has warned us the emperor has no clothes as the system of climate denial breaks down. What does it really mean? You are about to hear a knockout speech by Guy McPherson. He's the professor who left his tenured position at the University of Arizona School of Natural Resources to build his straw bale house and live in rural anarchy. Guy's popular blog is called Nature Bats Last at guymcpherson.com. His latest book is Walking Away from Empire. On November 2, 2012, McPherson spoke at the Bluegrass Bioneers Conference in Louisville, Kentucky. His stand-up performance was captured by organizer and filmmaker Ben Evans from Yurt.com. The video was posted on YouTube as a comedy, and there was some nervous laughter as McPherson landed blow after blow of the awful truth about climate change. I'm Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock. I prepared this audio for nonprofit radio broadcast. Off mic, McPherson told his audience he has some really horrible news and some good news. You might not like either one. Here is Guy McPherson.
The good news is this set of living arrangements is nearly done. In the not-too-distant future, we'll have no water coming out of the municipal taps, no food at the grocery store, no fuel at the filling station, no lights on here in the Empire. According to these 80 people, that'll happen by the end of this year. Now, some of these people have been wrong. Some of them have been wrong many times. Some of them haven't been wrong yet, but I bet they will be, because we only got 2 months to go. So it wouldn't surprise me if a long decline will end with a sudden and cataclysmic collapse of the world's industrial economy, which has been declining since 1999 or 2000, depending on which metric you use. So for a dozen years or so, we've been in decline of the industrial economy. If you think that can't happen quickly, that an empire can't fall relatively quickly, think about the events of the late 1980s and early 1990s. The last superpower didn't take a dozen years to fall. This is good news because if we stop this omnicidal, suicidal set of living arrangements that we call industrial civilization, then that will actually force us to stop climate chaos, which threatens us with near-term extinction. It will force us to stop human population overshoot, which proceeds currently at the rate of more than 200,000 individuals per day added to the planet. That's births minus deaths. 200,000 people per day brought into the world that they didn't choose to be brought into. It's not like we vote for that. We just appear here. Nobody chose this time in history. And we don't have food for those people. We don't have clean water. We don't have clean air for all those people we're adding every day. And there's 7 billion plus of us now. At what point do we stop the madness on an overpopulated planet? When the industrial economy collapses, and I'm not saying that it will happen this year or next year, but it will happen. The set of living arrangements will come to an end. All civilizations fall, including industrial civilization. When that happens, we'll be forced to slow or stop the sixth great extinction, which is proceeding apace at 200 species a day, every single life-destroying day. 200 species a day. That's genocide. That's what the industrial economy allows us and apparently forces us to do. 200 species a day, as if we have the right. And finally, termination of the set of living arrangements will force us to stop environmental decay. And here I'm thinking about every part of the world that has become worse every year of my 52 years on the planet. Everybody I know thinks every year has been better than the year before because we've got iPads and Kindles, right? But from my perspective, every year has been worse than the year before. Every year we have more soil that we wash into the world's oceans. Every year we foul more air and dirty more water. Every year we destroy every aspect of the living planet that we actually need to survive. And we think it's cool because we have smartphones. Let's make the right trade. And here comes the bad news. And most people stop right here, by the way. Most people stop with Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change with their five-year-old assessment of 1°C in 88 years. And we know so much more than that now. For a couple of reasons, we have an abundance of data. We're collecting climate data on an enormous level. And the models are so much better than they were 5 years ago. You probably know Moore's Law and the rapidity with which computational speed is increasing. So we know better than this, yet most people stop right here. By the way, 1°C is catastrophic. We've been convinced by a neoclassical economist, of all things, that 2°C is something we should worry about. William Nordhaus somehow hijacked the conversation and said 2°C is something to be worried about. 1 degree is no big deal. 1 degree is a big deal, as we've known for more than 20 years. 1°C temperature increase leads to rapid, unpredictable, and nonlinear responses that could, will, and have lead to extensive ecosystem damage. We've known this for over 20 years. This is one of the greatest cover-ups by the corporate media I've ever heard about. Hadley Center for Meteorological Research, hardly a left-wing organization, comes out a year after the IPCC with more computational power and more data and concludes that we're headed to a 2°C warmer world by the end of the century. And 2 degrees is truly catastrophic. 2 degrees, because of positive feedbacks or self-reinforcing feedback loops, leads almost immediately and with great certainty to 6°C. And the last time it was 6°C warmer on this planet than baseline, there were snakes the size of yellow school buses living in the Amazon, and the largest mammal on the planet was the size of a shrew. It was the largest mammal that can thermoregulate that kind of wet bulb temperature. This is huge, and nobody talks about it. President Obama expressed considerable surprise at an interview earlier this week that climate change didn't come up during the debates. Really? The scripted debates that you approved every damn question, climate change didn't come up? I'm shocked. We don't talk about this. It's too scary. United Nations Environment Program, 6 months after the Hadley Center's assessment. Hadley Center, let me tell you how left-wing they are. They were established by Margaret Thatcher. Some of us know. Many of you are too young to know. United Nations Environment Program comes along mid-2009, says we're headed for a 3.5°C warmer world by 2100. I'm halfway through these assessments, by the way. Hadley Center comes along just a year after their most recent assessment, says 4 is the new 2, and it's coming by mid-century. Remember, 2 leads to 6. 4 is the last nail in the coffin of the human experience. Consistent with that assessment, the Global Carbon Project and the Copenhagen diagnosis, at the time of the Copenhagen climate change meetings that the Obama administration threw under the bus, came up with 6 and 7°C warming by the end of the century. International Energy Agency, with their world energy outlook they produce every year the day after Thanksgiving, gee, nobody notices then. Huh. Probably a coinkidink. I don't know. IEA says in November of 2010 that we're at a 3.5°C warmer world by 2035. That's a big deal. By 2030, that's not very long from now, if I'm doing the math right. United Nations Environment Program, December of 2010, says more than 5°C by 2050. More than 5°C kills the oceans. The ocean becomes so acidified that essentially nothing can live there, including the thermophiles found at incredible depths at enormous temperatures. Phytoplankton in the ocean produce half our oxygen, by the way. I think we're going to have a hard time getting along without that. It's almost as if we might experience rapid, unpredictable, and nonlinear responses that could lead to extensive ecosystem damage. Stop me if you've heard that one before. And finally, the International Energy Agency, just a year after their previous assessment, comes up with 6°C by 2035. Wow! Less than 6 months later, they either capitulated or clarified what they were trying to say. And they said, no, we didn't mean by 2035. Even though you can find the press release online, that's exactly what it says. They said, we meant 2100. Huh, curious. The good news is that none of these assessments include economic collapse. The bad news, and you knew it was coming, is that none of them include positive feedbacks. Self-reinforcing feedback loops, none. These all assume simple linear projections from 1 year to the next, from 1 decade to the next. Let's talk about those positive feedback loops. The only major assessment that I know about was conducted more than a year ago, so it's ancient history at this point, by the National Center for Atmospheric Research. They conclude we're headed for 16 degrees C increase by 2100. It's kind of a big deal. And climate scientist Paul Beckwith at the University of Ottawa, at the middle of last month, pointed out that we could observe a 6 degrees C temperature increase within a decade because of positive feedbacks. It's almost as if, stop me if you've heard this one, we could experience rapid, unpredictable, and nonlinear responses that could lead to extensive ecosystem damage. I think that's about right. We've known this for 22 years. Just when you think it can't get any worse, I have another slide. According to the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science, one of the premier science journals in the entire world, in a paper published in February 2009, so a long time ago now, climate change is irreversible. What the paper actually found was that the atmospheric level of carbon dioxide today is the minimum level we will observe for at least the next 1,000 years. So we're at an average carbon dioxide concentration in the atmosphere right now of 396 parts per million. And we will be at 396 parts per million for at least the next 1,000 years. That's the minimum. 350.org is a bad joke. It's disingenuous or ignorant. There is no way we'll see 350.org, 350 parts per million CO2 within at least the next 1,000 years. Promoting that as if we could get there is ridiculous. United Nations Environment Program during 2008, the most catastrophic year of the catastrophic Great Recession. We can't call them depressions anymore because that's too depressing. So we call them recessions now. Big ones. Great recessions. Great. That was great for me. Was it good for you?
Very recessing.
During 2008, global carbon emissions increased to their highest level since we fully implemented the Clean Air Act in this country. But that was nothing compared to what was coming. 2009, we increased over that record-setting year by 6.2%. 2010, we increased over that record-setting year by 6.5%. 2011, we increased over that record-setting year by 3.4%. We're in an economic Great Depression, and carbon emissions keep going up. We can't just slow the industrial economy. Instead, only economic collapse will prevent runaway climate change. There's an amazing story behind this paper. Tim Garrett from the University of Utah submitted this paper to 10 journals before he could find one that would publish it. And then it was published in Climatic Change, one of the premier journals in climate sciences. He submitted it there in February 2007. It was accepted and printed online in November of 2009. And there was immediately a big outcry from the scientific community who said, no, we can't stop this set of living arrangements. That would be bad. So before it was published, it was held back for nearly 2 years so that people could write responses. So there are two responses to this article to which Garrett was not allowed to respond that were published at the same time as the print version of his paper. This is politics severely interfering with science, in my opinion. It sort of reminds me when I go on speaking tours, I sometimes ask the host if I'm speaking at a high school or for younger students, I ask if I should maybe not talk about economic collapse because some people find that depressing, oddly. But that's my good news. And I was speaking in New York last year, and I wrote to the science coordinator at the school where I was going to be speaking. I said, so a lot of times people don't want me to talk about economic collapse to high school students, so I won't talk about that if that's okay. And she said, yeah, that would be bad. We don't want to upset the kids. I said, okay, tongue in cheek. I'm just kidding. I said, how about if I talk about, three paths to near-term human extinction? She says, that'd be great. If a paper in Bioscience earlier this year, a prestigious academic journal, researchers went and translated Thoreau's extensive notes from the 1840s, a series of years in the 1840s, right before the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. Most people peg that at 1850. So Thoreau was out there around Concord, Massachusetts, collecting extensive information on the first flowering dates of all the plants in the area. It was quite the naturalist. And somebody went through and transcribed all those notes, which were essentially unreadable, because apparently his handwriting was even worse than mine. And they transcribed all those and figured out the first flowering dates of all the plants in the area around Concord, Massachusetts. And then they went out in the late 2000s, aughts, so between 2005 and the following few years, and collected the same information. And what they found was, if we believe the plants instead of the sensors, the area around Concord, Massachusetts is actually warmed by about 2.4 degrees centigrade. The sensors all indicate that that area has warmed by 1 degree. I'm more inclined to believe the plants than our instruments. If we believe the plants, we're already at 2 degrees C. And I suspect that's why we're seeing numerous positive feedbacks, six of which I know we've triggered, first five of which lead to near-term human extinction.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with a recording of Dr. Guy McPherson at the Bluegrass Bioneers Conference in Louisville, Kentucky, November 2, 2012. Guy gives us the no-holds-barred assessment of what we have been told and what we haven't about the developing wreck of Earth's climate. His good news sounds pretty bad, but it's better than extinction. I'll hold my notes and comments to the end of the speech. Here is McPherson on positive feedback loops, those great natural processes triggered by adding greenhouse gases to the atmosphere.
So I want to talk about those feedbacks briefly. All these were reported relatively recently. The scientific community is unbelievably conservative. That's why most scientists are still using the IPCC's fourth assessment, 5 years old, and waiting for the next assessment, which is due out in 2 years, to base their next projections on. Based on data from the summer of 2010, this paper appeared in January 2011 in Science and pointed out that the Arctic is defrosting because warm Atlantic water is shooting up through the Fram Strait off the north and east coasts of Greenland directly into the Arctic Sea. So we have warm Atlantic water that previously always reversed course at Greenland as part of the thermohaline conveyor belt. And instead of reversing course, now it's just shooting straight up through the Fram Strait off the north and east coast of Greenland, taking warm Atlantic water into the Arctic. First time that's been reported in recorded history. It was 2010, a signature year for climate studies. I suspect we're going to see an ice-free Arctic within the next 3 years. If so, it'll be the first time for 3 million years. Before there were human beings on the planet, in other words. It'll be the first time in 3 million years there'll be an ice-free Arctic. We're on path for that to happen in 2014 or 2015. From various other sources, the first four of these are peer-reviewed science papers. We have five other positive feedbacks, any one of which, again, leads to the direction we don't want to go. The first of those is peat in the world's boreal forests, which is decomposing very rapidly. So water table falls, peat is exposed to the air, it decomposes and becomes carbon in the atmosphere almost immediately, contributing to warming and drying of the atmosphere, which causes the water table to decline, which exposes more peat to the air, which causes it to decompose, which causes warming and drying. So that's a classic positive feedback. In Siberia, on the ground, the permafrost is melting so rapidly that methane is being vented from the ground. So you can see this stuff on YouTube. In 2010, again, a signature year for climate studies, 2010 researchers would go out to Siberia and they'd find these vents and they were about 30 centimeters in diameter, about a foot across, and they would light them on fire. Because this is what scientists do. They play with fire. That was 2010. 2011, those methane events were a kilometer across. It's almost as if, stop me if I've heard this before, there will be rapid, unpredictable, and nonlinear responses. 3 orders of magnitude increase in the size of those vents in 1 year. That's rapid. That's unpredictable. That's amazing. At the same time, we can light Siberia on fire. Methane is also escaping from the world's oceans, and particularly in the Arctic. There are methane hydrates or clathrates. Those are synonyms, little cages of methane that are floating up to the surface as the ocean warms, and then the methane is being released into the atmosphere. Methane is about 100 times more powerful a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide in the short term, 20 to 30 times more powerful molecule for molecule than carbon dioxide in the long term, over 100 years or so, but we don't have 100 years. 2011, someplace in the Arctic, it looked like ginger ale, because the methane was bubbling out so quickly. And then again from 2010, a drought in the Amazon that was so profound that just as a result of natural decomposition, natural drying, natural decomposition of the Amazon forest, which is supposed to be a net sequesterer of carbon. Instead, decomposition was proceeding so quickly that the Amazon basin released more carbon than all the cars, trucks, and coal-fired power plants in the United States combined in 2010. It's supposed to be the lungs of the planet, and they're giving up all that carbon dioxide. In 2010, producing more carbon into the atmosphere than the entire United States. We're number one. And then the most recent, the one that's not reported in the Referee Journal literature and won't be for 15 years, it's such a slow process, is drilling in the Arctic. And so the more there's open water, the more it allows us to go up there and drill for oil and gas. And then we burn it, and that makes the water more open. You know where this goes. The Arctic Methane Emergency Group looks at one of those positive feedbacks, methane, in one region in the Arctic, and concludes that in 2010, not surprisingly, it appears that methane has gone exponential. That's 2010 right there on the right-hand side with the red dots going straight up. And the author is Malcolm Light. This came out February of this year, and Malcolm Light predicts extinction by mid-century. And I'm going to read here. Oh. Methane release will accelerate exponentially. He reports that it has accelerated exponentially. Release huge quantities of methane into the atmosphere and lead to the demise of all life on Earth before the middle of this century. He pegged it to, for the Northern Hemisphere, to 2031.6. I left off the decimal place. He's a scientist. September. Look for that in September in the Northern Hemisphere. And 2047.8 in the Southern Hemisphere. All life on Earth. And I thought that was hyperbolic when I first read it, because I thought, thermophiles? How are you going to kill thermophiles? Methane-eating bacteria? But then I thought about, well, you know, that there would be rapid, unpredictable, and nonlinear responses that could lead to extensive ecosystem damage. And so, yeah, it might kill everything. It certainly is the end of the line for the human experience when we get to those kinds of conditions. At this point, I would like you to breathe. I put that in there just to remind me. Just tell everybody to breathe and act like it's going to be okay, even though obviously it's not. We can tell ourselves little lies. I didn't eat ice cream for lunch. Okay, so now what? What do we do in the face of this information? Most people I know will just run from it, right? We'll pretend that this never happened. So I went and had an affair. So you'll deny that you ever knew me. Guy who? No, never heard of him. So what I suggest we do is to channel little Springsteen. In the end, when you don't surrender, well, the world just strips away. So let go. Let go. Or be dragged. Seize the day. Or, quote my own personal hero, live as though the day were here. I'm over being judgmental about the way people live. I think we don't have a long time left on this planet. And if you're living in the interior of a large continent in the Northern Hemisphere, you are truly, totally in trouble. Now I have the really good news. It'll have to be really good, won't it? I mean, the bar here has got to be high, right?
Yeah.
I can't believe you're all still here. And I'm still alive. This is stunning on two counts already. We're amazing. You're amazing. We're all of it. I'm not doing the Tony Robbins thing here. We really are amazing. You get to die. You get to die. And that makes you the lucky one. The lucky ones. Because you got to live. You know what the odds are? You know what we know from DNA, from our knowledge of DNA? You know what the odds are against any one of us being here? They're astronomical. And yet, here you are. In the teeth of these stupefying odds, it is you and I that are privileged to be here, privileged with eyes to see where we are and brains to wonder why. And now you're thinking, why? Why did I come here? Why? No, I mean why in the greater sense. What underlies the Armageddon we have triggered? And it is Armageddon. You can't call 200 species a day merely an extinction crisis. It's Armageddon. We have triggered Armageddon. We've been pursuing it for quite a long time. What underlies it is our drive to consume. The way we live, particularly in this country, like this, suburbia, not quite city, not quite country, requires us to live far from where we work, far from where we play, far from where we shop, for all the things we think we need with the money we don't have, forces us to consume. What underlies the industrial economy of the United States? 70% of it is underlain by personal consumption. In the wake of 9/11, how do we get out of that mess? Go to the mall. That's what your president said. Go to the mall. Got to consume our way back on track to greatness. Consume. Consume to do away with completely. Destroy. To spend wastefully. To squander. It's almost biblical, really. To what? To waste or burn away. To perish. And this is a good thing? This is the best they can tell us? Is to consume? To maintain this set of living arrangements requires obedience at home, oppression abroad, and whole-scale destruction of the living planet on which we depend for our actual lives. Just think about oppression abroad, for example. Anybody gets in the way of our oil, we kill them. It's that simple. That's the Carter Doctrine. The last decent man in the Oval Office, Jimmy Carter, comes up with the doctrine that says, with respect to the Middle East, that's our oil over there. Jimmy Carter, the Marcus Aurelius of his day, knew what it took to maintain an empire in decline. Obedience at home? Well, that panel is from Alabama, when in the wake of the great financial crisis in September 2008, citizens were legally protesting illegal actions by local banks, and in response, the National Guard was illegally brought in to quash the protests. That's just a minor example of obedience at home. If you want more, look to the NDAA, National Defense Authorization Act 2012, signed in the dark of night on New Year's Eve, December 31st, 2011, in which, for the first time since passage of the Magna Carta in 1215, we suspend habeas corpus in peacetime. And nobody says a thing. That's the astonishing part of this. We suspend habeas corpus in the civilized world for the first time since passage of the Magna Carta, and nobody says a word. Well, Chris Hedges and a couple other guys sue, and they win in court, and the Obama administration ignores that. Here's another example of obedience at home. In 2000, when George W. Bush was running for president of the United States, he would speak on college campuses, and occasionally a lone student would stand up and express his or her First Amendment rights, freedom of expression, turn his or her back on the future president of the United States, and stand in silent protest. Other students would notice they'd stand up and turn their back too. In some places, a third or a half of the students, by the time George W. Bush was done speaking, had their backs turned to him. It was massively underreported, but it happened all over the country. That's the year 2000. Fast forward 10 years, one decade, Hillary Clinton is speaking in Washington, D.C., and a well-known man in Washington, D.C. stands up and in silent protest turns his back on the Secretary of State. Ray McGovern, 71 years old, former CIA analyst, prepared the daily intelligence briefing for four United States presidents. I think probably people knew who he was that day in Washington, D.C. He stands up. He's 71 years old. He stands up and, in expressing his First Amendment rights, turns on the Secretary of State silently. And they beat him bloody and threw him in jail. Obedience is not allowed. Resistance is futile. Not in this country. Not anymore. It's amazing to me. I came of age in a time of resistance in this country. Now I hardly recognize the country I grew up in. The trouble is that once you see it, you can't unsee it. And once you've seen it, keeping quiet, saying nothing becomes as political an act as speaking out. There's no innocence. Either way, you're accountable. Unfortunately, I saw it, and I couldn't unsee it. So I walked away. I had a job for life. I was a tenured full professor, and I won all the awards and all that. I was actually banned from teaching in my home department for the last several years I was there. I was asking students to think, to question the dominant paradigm. So I was teaching poetry in prisons. So I was paid to not show up. Can you imagine? Paid to not show up, a job for life. But I couldn't live at the apex of empire and point out the dark underbelly of the industrial economy and look myself in the mirror. You just can't do that for an extended period of time. I couldn't unsee it. So now what? Now what for me is walking away from empire. I live decidedly outside mainstream culture in agrarian anarchy. Anarchy is not chaos, by the way. Chaos is an absence of rules. Anarchy is an absence of rulers. In anarchy, you take responsibility for yourself and for your neighbors. I used anarchy in my classrooms for 15 years at the University of Arizona. Where I live now, people take responsibility for their neighbors, human and otherwise. That's anarchy. I live at the edge of empire, still in the empire, because there's no escape. Off the grid, in a straw bale house I refer to as the mud hut, promoting a gift economy and living a gift economy. Your mileage might vary. So, I don't know what this means for you. Near-term collapse of the set of living arrangements we call industrial civilization. Near-term human extinction. I don't know what that means for you. I barely know what it means for me. I had to act in a way that matched my moral imperative. I recognize that that's almost impossible. So responding to this existential crisis we face is almost impossible. It's paralyzing. It's debilitating. But it's not quite impossible. So I want you to keep that in mind. If you want more of this, and who wouldn't? You can follow my writing at naturebatslastgodmcpherson.com, and I write a monthly essay at Transition Voice as well. And I want to thank everybody for being here, and thank you very much. I'd be happy to entertain any questions or comments.
You've just heard Professor Emeritus Guy McPherson with his speech at the Bluegrass Bioneers Conference in Louisville, Kentucky, November 2nd, 2012. Find a link to the YouTube video at GuyMcPherson.com or in my Radio EcoShock blog at EcoShock.info. I am Alex Smith. My thanks to Ben West of Yurt.com for the video and Guy McPherson for telling it like it is.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at EcoShock.org.
I didn't want to run Guy McPherson's speech just to titillate our taste for disaster porn. I fact-checked pretty well every statement McPherson made before I was willing to run it. My pages of notes have been condensed into an entry for Radio EcoShock at our blog at ecoshock.info. You can chase the links for yourself and verify what Guy is saying. Guy McPherson referenced a scientific paper in the prestigious journal Climatic Change. The title is On the Coupled Evolution of Inflation, Wealth, and Atmospheric Concentrations of Carbon Dioxide, and that is by Professor Timothy Garrett. In a Radio EcoShock interview on November 19, 2010, Professor Garrett says his research showed only a big economic collapse could save us from the worst of climate change. Here is that clip. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Dr. Timothy Garrett, an atmospheric scientist from the University of Utah. And I'd like to really get to the conclusions of your new paper. Based on our past records of energy use and wealth, what does your model show as possible futures?
Well, in fact, I mean, this was actually stimulated by our past conversation. In my first study, I showed that carbon dioxide emissions and wealth were intrinsically coupled. Without actually decarbonizing the economy, like switching to renewables or nuclear power at an extraordinarily fast rate, you cannot have wealth without having carbon dioxide emissions. The two go together. And in fact, since 1970, the relationship between the two has been very, very tightly fixed. Now, that would seem to have implications for the future because carbon dioxide emissions accumulate in the atmosphere. As carbon dioxide emissions accumulate in the atmosphere, some fraction goes into what we call sinks in the oceans and the land, but about half of what we emit accumulates in the atmosphere. That is going to create an ever-increasing pressure on civilization. Now, by eating away at civilization wealth, global warming will actually reduce our capacity to emit carbon dioxide. So there's actually what you would call in physics a negative feedback. So our wealth is emitting CO2. CO2 accumulates in the atmosphere and then feeds back on our capacity to produce new wealth. Eventually, one could imagine that civilization would enter into a phase of collapse because the carbon dioxide levels are so high that we're simply unable to produce new goods without them being destroyed by global warming. And at that point, perhaps emissions would go down. And eventually, if civilization collapsed fast enough, then perhaps carbon dioxide concentrations would be stabilized. Now, you asked me last time what would be required to keep carbon dioxide concentrations at 450 parts per million. And that's normally what's considered to be about a dangerous level by, let's say, during the Copenhagen Accord. And I made a guess that it would require actually flat-out civilization collapse, and based on some preliminary work I did, and then I decided to look into this a bit more deeply, and I actually wrote a second paper where it turns out that is true. Not only would we have to have civilization collapse starting very, very soon, like within the next decade or so, but we would also have to have extremely rapid decarbonization in order to keep carbon dioxide levels below, let's say, 500 parts per million, twice pre-industrial levels. In order to keep them below 1,000, well, without civilization collapse, let's say we have continuing health, let's say that the civilization is very resilient to global warming, then carbon dioxide levels are going to go extremely high by the end of the century, probably above 1,000 parts per million. If you think about 1,000 parts per million, well, that's probably depends on what the climate sensitivity is, but that's something along the lines of 5 degrees Celsius warming at least. And when we think of 5 degrees Celsius warming, people are familiar with this, usually start bringing up highly catastrophic scenarios. So in some sense, it's hard to imagine how civilization cannot be in pretty dire straits during this century.
That was Professor Tim Garrett from the University of Utah, appearing on Radio EcoShock in November 2010. In other news, the World Bank has released a new report about climate change. It warns we are heading to a world hotter by 4 degrees Celsius, or 7.2 degrees Fahrenheit, by the year 2100. In fact, as we'll hear in our next interview from the Potsdam Institute in Germany, on our current course of emissions, we might even get that hot by 2060. That would be devastating for humans, for our civilization, and for all the creatures on the planet who have evolved to live in the Holocene era, between the great ice ages. In some places, what was a normal summer will become a normal winter. The Mediterranean will be scorched 9 degrees hotter at times, fires and heat waves. Cities by the sea, like New York, London, and so many others in Europe, China, and India, will be regularly flooded, if not partially abandoned, due to rising seas. And we've had a new report showing just how much those rising seas are happening already, as Greenland is melting and parts of the Antarctic are also melting. The great Amazon rainforest at 4 degrees would disappear, along with the coral reefs that nurture so much of sea life. It's ugly. And the report is titled, Turn Down the Heat, Why a 4-degree Warmer World Must Be Avoided. Let's begin with the regular Radio EcoShock contributor, Daphne Wysham, this time on Al Jazeera TV, November 30th, 2012, just as the report was released by the World Bank. American listeners, of course, cannot get this information on TV due to state or big corporate censorship.
The heat must be turned down. A report issued by the World Bank earlier this month warns of severe consequences if global warming isn't dealt with. But isn't the international organization itself contributing to climate change? You're watching Inside Story Americas from Washington. Hello, I'm Shihab Ratansi. Extreme heat waves, declining food stocks, and a life-threatening sea level rise. It's a sobering vision of the future by one of the world's largest and most powerful institutions. The World Bank says that the only way climate change can be dealt with is by, quote, cooperative international actions, end quote. But the financial institution itself is providing billions of dollars for schemes that contribute to global warming. According to the watchdog group, the Bank Information Center, in 2010, its funding for fossil fuel projects hit an all-time high of $6.6 billion. That's a 116% increase from the year before. And most of those loans went towards coal. And while the bank's own report, Turn Down the Heat, warns of dire consequences for the planet if more action is not taken, it doesn't provide any concrete steps that must be implemented by international leaders or by its own organization. Here in the studio, we have Daphne Wysham. She is the founder of the Sustainable Energy and Economy Network. Let's begin with the World Bank's report, because clearly no one can say the World Bank doesn't understand the scale of the problem, at least. The report said that the world is headed for an average temperature rise of 4 degrees Celsius by the end of the 21st century, possibly as soon as 2060. It will make summer temperatures higher by as much as 6 degrees Celsius across North Africa, the Mediterranean, the Middle East, and the United States. The report also says rising CO2 levels will lead to a, quote, unparalleled rise in ocean acidity, which would wipe out the world's coral reefs and fish stocks. It also projects that higher temperatures will trigger an extinction crisis amongst some animal species and a 1 meter rise in sea levels by the end of the century. Because, I mean, the evidence has been mounting for some time now about, you know, how disastrous man-made climate change is, and yet, if anything, the World Bank seems to have accelerated the amount of investment in fossil fuels. Here are some examples. In Kosovo, the bank is financing a coal power station which will use brown coal, the most polluting sort. The plant will increase the country's carbon emissions up to 400%. In South Africa, $3.75 billion in World Bank loans are going to Eskom, the largest power utility company in Africa. It's constructing 2 coal-fired power plants with those funds, but has been criticized for failing to consider the impact on air and water quality. I mean, they must know that these coal-fired power stations are potentially disastrous to the planet, and indeed all of their mandate, really, on poverty reduction and, you know, sustainable development. And yet, it goes on.
And yet it goes on, and it's been going on for 20 years. I mean, it was 1992 when the World Bank was asked at the Rio Earth Summit to begin to marshal the funds to address the climate crisis, to help the developing world move away from fossil fuels. And they've done the exact opposite. I mean, you've named some of the top projects. There's also the Tata Mundra project in India that was a huge fiasco and is now being challenged by people in India on the ground, both for its environmental impact as well as for its human rights impact.
But at Rio, were they specifically tasked with switching course, though, and looking into sustainable?
Yes, they have failed miserably. And what we documented back in 1997 was that over 5 years, the World Bank had provided finance to fossil fuel projects that would emit the equivalent, over their lifetimes now, of 1 year's worth of global greenhouse gas emissions. That's a huge number. The World Bank challenged our methodology. Dan is talking about them coming out with a methodology to finally assess their climate impact. But we're saying, you know, first of all, methodologies are not rocket science, A. And B, we know what causes climate change. Just stop funding the dirty stuff. There are plenty of private banks out there perfectly capable of funding coal-fired power plants. The bank makes the argument, well, we do it cleaner, we do it better, we assure best practices. Yeah. All of that is not a justification for using this public money. Well, one of the points I wanted to make is back in 2004, their own review said that the poor were actually worse off as a result of these investments in fossil fuels, that the poor, that the people they are supposed to be serving, providing energy and electricity to, are actually worse off because most of them are being resettled, they're breathing dirtier air, and they're not even getting power, or their rates are going up. So my point is, first do no harm. Yes, methodologies are important, absolutely. First do no harm. We are doing more harm than good with these investments. We know what we need to do. We need to do a rapid investment in renewables. We could do a global feed-in tariff for renewable energy.
From these projects,
well, we've actually looked into that very closely, and it turns out for every dollar that the U.S. invests in the World Bank, they get back roughly $1.30 in procurement contracts, and that goes for all of the other countries that invest.
That was Daphne Wysham on Inside Story Americas with host Shebab Ratansi, broadcast on Al Jazeera TV November 30th. Now it's time to hear from the Potsdam Institute, who wrote that report, Turn Down the Heat. Olivia Maria Sardachny is a research analyst for Professor Schellenhuber and Ramsdorf at the German Advisory Council on Global Change to the federal government there. Olivia was part of a team producing the report, Turn Down the Heat, Why a 4-Degree Warmer World Must Be Avoided. That's from the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research. It was released in November 2012, and it was written for the World Bank. Olivia, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me there.
Olivia, how did this report for the World Bank evolve with the Potsdam Institute?
Yes, so when in July this year, President Kim was appointed as World Bank President, he wanted to investigate what climate change, how severe an impact it could be for the development world, so which would have obviously affect his institute's policies. And it was basically only a scoping report they asked us for, to briefly sketch out what would be the consequences of a 4 degrees centigrade warming by the end of the century, which is sort of a best guess of how bad it could get in a worst case by the end of the century. So we sat down and got the experts at the Institute together to write a report on impacts in a 4 degrees world. And that was then presented by our director, who was lead author of the study, to the president of the World Bank. And from what they told us, it was a bit like a wake-up call, because they realized just how important and how big a problem it might be also for the development world. And that was when we were commissioned to further map out the impacts of a 4-degree world and write this report.
And is your director John Schellenhuber?
Yes, that is him.
Well, now, how likely is it that the average Earth temperature will warm by 4 degrees? That's 7.2 degrees Fahrenheit. And how soon could that happen?
Well, ultimately, it will depend on political decisions to curb greenhouse gas emissions or not. But if current pledges are actually put in place and met, there will likely be a warming of more or less 3 degrees centigrade by the end of the century. And even under these current pledges that were agreed upon in Copenhagen and reaffirmed in Cancun, so if these current pledges are met, there's a 20% chance of the world warming by 4 degrees by the end of the century. Now, if these pledges are not met and emissions rise faster than currently with further economic growth, 4 degrees warming could even occur by the 2060s, but that is with lower probability. More or less, however, we did look at the end of the century, so we looked at scenarios 4 degrees warming by the end of the century.
And your report did look at a series of frightening consequences of letting the climate warm that far to 4 degrees centigrade. Can you talk about the possible human health impacts?
Well, I can tell you what we covered in the report, and basically there is one example that are vector-borne diseases. So these are diseases transmitted, for example, by mosquitoes. And mosquitoes and the spread of them is affected by precipitation and temperature change. So with 4 degrees warming, you have a big change in the regional temperatures and in precipitation. And as that changes, mosquitoes migrate differently and carry malaria to new places. For example, malaria is such a vector-borne disease. So this disease with them would spread further towards areas where there is no immunity yet. And then you have more indirect impacts. For example, when you have increased occurrence of floods, you have waterborne diseases spreading further, diarrheal diseases also due to higher floods and different rainfall patterns. If you have lower agricultural yields in some regions, you might have to cope with under or malnutrition. And then there are, of course, all these projected impacts of extreme events. So already in the past and in the developed world, actually, such impacts were observed in the summer heat wave of 2003, which spread over Europe. There was an excess, total excess deaths at an estimated 77,000 people dying in Europe due to extreme heat events. So with 4 degrees warming, there would be more extreme heat events, and probably if people will not be able to adapt to that, further heat excess deaths as well.
So it's not just the developing world who will be hurt by this. Who will be hurt the most and who the least? Are there winners and losers in this 4-degree warmer world?
Well, I'm not aware of any winners at this very point. Maybe the very, very rich who can adapt very well at national scales, but we didn't look at these scenarios. However, the poor and underdeveloped countries would be disproportionately affected, which is more or less due to two reasons. One is that they have the least adaptive capacity, so the poor have the least means to withstand impacts. And actually, physically, the impacts are projected to also be worst in tropical and subtropical regions where you have many developing countries. So, for example, even sea level rise will not rise, or is projected not to rise uniformly, but is estimated to be 15 to 20% larger in the tropics than in the global mean. So countries there and coastal systems would be affected more there as well. And, for example, temperatures would, so in the tropics you have temperatures high day and night already, so the absolute increase wouldn't be higher than in the higher latitudes, but the relative increase, so ecosystems and people have adapted to temperatures as they are there for a long time. And as they would rise even further, they would be disproportionately affected as well. And the same goes for aridity and drought. These are likely to substantially increase in tropical and subtropical areas, more so than at higher latitudes.
And what about the economy? I wonder whether our current industrial civilization can survive the challenges of a rapid shift to a different climate. Did you look at the economic impact?
Well, no, we do certainly wonder as well. We have looked at a few studies that did investigate the link between rising temperatures and economic growth. And there has been impact observed, for example, for 1 degree rise in regional temperatures. There was a 1.3% decrease in economic growth. So there are plausible linkages of, for example, how it reduces the labor force, or actually just how capital damages are done to infrastructure. But we did not investigate further what this actually would mean for the global economy.
This is Radio EcoShock. We are talking about the report, Turn Down the Heat, Why a 4-Degree Warmer World Must Be Avoided, from the Potsdam Institute. Olivia Sardenci, what would happen to the animals and plants?
Well, I cannot tell you about each animal and plant specifically, but I can tell you that a 4-degree world would be an unprecedented world, not only to human beings, but also to ecosystems that have adapted to the world as we know it now throughout evolution or since the last glacial period. You could term it a sixth mass extinction that would have started to occur by then already. So you would have a few ecosystems that could not migrate any further as temperatures change. For example, so polar bears obviously are the most poignant example, but also mountaintop ecosystems that at some point could not migrate further north to colder temperatures because there would be no mountain anymore. Those would be are projected to become extinct. And the same goes for larger ecosystems like the Amazon forest, for example. So already at a 2-degree centigrade warming, forest fires in the Amazon are in some studies projected to double, with huge impacts on the animals that live in these ecosystems, of course. So it would be unprecedented impacts on ecosystems that are already under stress from multiple human activities like habitat change. But in a 4-degree world, probably climate change would be the driving factor.
Did your report look at the impact of a 4-degree world on ocean life?
We did look at ocean acidification, which is the other CO2 problem, as it has been called. So as carbon dioxide enters the sea, it dissolves and enters a chemical reaction that ultimately results in ocean acidification. And at a 4-degree warming, it's basically unlikely that coral reefs would survive at all. So coral reefs are very sensitive to changes in ocean acidity and ocean water temperatures. Coral bleaching, for example, has been linked to ocean temperatures. And already now, corals are experiencing decreased growth rates and damages. So it is quite likely that with atmospheric carbon dioxide concentrations rising further, such that they would result in 2 degrees warming, coral reefs would actually start to dissolve. So this is a major ecosystem impact in the sea, in the oceans, that would result from 4 degrees warming. We did not so much look at the impacts of ocean waters warming on ecosystems, but there are studies as well, and we mentioned a few of them, pointing out that fish stocks would migrate further north, so that would actually also affect coastal fisheries.
Well, I know, Olivia, that some of our listeners are thinking that we'll just adapt to a warmer world using human ingenuity. Isn't that possible?
I wouldn't dare to say it's impossible, but I definitely doubt we actually know the answer. We did sketch out a few impacts of a 4-degree warming, but it's really just a few pieces of the jigsaw. So we don't actually know the full scale of impacts in a 4-degree world. I guess it's quite easy to imagine that these impacts would interact. So, for example, if you have changes in water availability, this will affect agricultural yields, and this will affect health, and health in turn will be affected by high temperatures. So it all, you know, coalesces, it all works together. And we don't really know what this net sum of impacts would be. We don't know what the world in a 4-degree world looks like to which we would adapt. And therefore, I don't think we can know whether we know if we can adapt. You know, if you don't even know the scale of the impact, it's fairly too optimistic from my personal point of view to say we'll just adapt, because it's a world we've never lived in and we don't know how much we can cope with it. Plus, it's, like I said, the poorest that are likely to be affected most, and they have the least means to actually really adapt, no matter how large human ingenuity might be.
Well, speaking of things that we're not very sure about, very few climate assessments try to include positive feedback loops, like the emissions from melting permafrost or frozen methane under the shallow seas. Did the Potsdam Institute report for the World Bank include feedback calculations?
We did not make any feedback calculations ourselves. We did analyze already existing climate data from the CMIP-5 project. So there was the Climate Model Intercomparison Project in its fifth phase. And I have to say, I'm not sure which of these models include any feedback systems. What we did was that we analyzed their data for heat waves. So we looked at their rates of warming and how many heat waves would occur according to these models. But again, I'm not sure they include feedback loops themselves.
Okay, and John Schellenhuber, as you mentioned, is the director of the Potsdam Institute, and at the 4 degrees or More conference in Australia in 2011, Dr. Schellenhuber suggested the climate may not be stable at 4 degrees. It could tilt even further towards 6 or 8 degrees. Can you comment on that?
Well, I unfortunately wasn't there. I wish I would have been, but I'm sure he was speaking of the tipping points that also relate to the feedback loops you had just mentioned. So, for example, the permafrost in the upper latitudes, if that was to melt, more methane and carbon dioxide would be emitted, leading to further warming. So it's, yes, the more the world would warm towards a 4 degrees warming, the more likely these tipping points could be accelerated, leading to further warming. Also, it is, so in the scenario we looked at, we did not assume that emissions would just stop and warming would just stop there. It's just, you know, from a human point of view, also unlikely that once we have reached 4 degrees warming, emissions would immediately stop, and warming with a time lag would then as well.
Given these dire predictions in the report, 4 degrees, turn down the heat, what policy changes could the World Bank or even world governments make to stave off a climate catastrophe?
Well, ultimately, it's the reduction of carbon dioxide emissions or other greenhouse gases that need to be curbed and completely avoided in the further future. So I guess from a development point of view, the goal should be to try the green growth, really, or not try, but do the green growth in developed countries. So, you know, don't have them go down the path that we did and develop on a fossil fuel basis, but rather have the developing countries leapfrog into a world of renewable energies and clean energy and power, which would also have co-benefits on health, by the way. In the developing country, in the developing world, there is a reported 1.6 million deaths, I believe, per year due to the burning of fossil fuels in households. So it's actually a fairly unhealthy way to develop in certain respects. So if the developed world helped the developing world to install renewable energies and meet energy poverty from this side, help them develop and economically grow in a green, clean way, if you like, I guess this would be the best scenario from both a climate and a developing perspective.
I want to ask you on a personal level, how did you get swept up into all of this, and how do you cope with knowing what we know?
Well, I got swept up in all this. As I said, I worked for Jan Schellenhuber, the director of the Institute. So when we were commissioned with it, I did it because it was my job, so to speak. And I followed through from beginning to end, so to say, in this position. And it was rather worrying, I have to say. It was actually the experience of all the scientists who were involved that once you start gathering information that is out there on what could happen in a 4 degrees world, it's a really scary scenario, because usually, you know, scientists work in their field and they're more or less used to the projections they know. But once you collect all these jigsaw pieces together and a picture starts emerging, it sort of really hits you to then think, well, this might just become real by the end of the century, and you know, it's still our lifetime. You sort of, you want to suppress it because you want to still live your everyday life, and you don't want to get depressed. But it's a very sobering, if not frightening, prospect that even us scientists working on this report gathered throughout writing it.
Very well. From Germany, our guest has been Olivia Maria Sardeczny from the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research. You can find a link to the report, 4 Degrees, Turn Down the Heat, in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Olivia, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. I know Radio EcoShock has been blaring the bad news about climate for the past many shows, but there is a little good news coming. It turns out there are plenty of inventive people all over the world trying out new solutions. I promise you, before this month is out, you will hear a lot about the ways we can change toward survival. So hang in there. I'm Alex. Please turn your friends on to our broadcast and our website at ecoshock.org. Thank you again for listening this week.